Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butter fat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice of chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label. And for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
The story of two best friends opening a restaurant together is something that people can get behind. I think many of us over the years have talked with our best friend about having a business together. And so that was something that people got excited about and they talked about it. And because the news cycle was fairly bleak and it really resonated. It was awesome.
You're listening to the Taste Podcast. I'm editor-in-chief Matt Rodbard, here with senior editor Anna Hiesel.
Today is a fun episode because Matt is talking to Daniel Holtzman, the chef at the Meatball Shop and friend of the podcast.
Yeah, Daniel Holtzman is a good friend of mine. We co-write a column on Taste. He's been a buddy for years. Dan is now living in Los Angeles, where we recorded this interview. But we go back to New York. We talk about his time working at Le Bernard Dan in high school, which he's got lots of good stories. And also what excites him in food today. Daniel Holtzman has many opinions.
Later on, Matt will be speaking to Matt and Ted Lee, a writer duo made up of two brothers.
Yeah, Matt and Ted, they've written about Southern food for years. They've been known as these go-to thought leaders in the South. But in their latest book, Hot Box, it's a little different. They talk about this, the world of catering, the seedy underbelly of catering. And they actually went undercover for a couple years and worked in the catering industry. It's a really fascinating book, and we talk about it in this interview.
That will be coming up after this conversation between Matt and Dan Holtzman.
Daniel Holtzman, welcome to the Taste Podcast.
Big fan. Very glad to be here. Muchas gracias, as they say here, in what used to be Mexico.
Used to be Mexico. We're actually in Venice. We're in your home. You have moved to Venice, California.
I live by the beach. I surf. Do a lot of juicing in the morning. You know, very fresh.
Pilates.
Reformer only.
But you moved here. You lived in New York for over a decade, and you've moved back to LA, and we can talk about a little bit of your cooking history because I want to get into that. But let's just like set the table a little bit. We've been friends for a long time. We're writing partners. We've written column for a couple places, Savour, and now at Taste.
We've the inimitable.
Yeah,
Taste
right. Shine it cooking. Up. But like, what, like, how did we meet? Do you remember?
I feel like we met. We certainly met at some function surrounding the meatball shop. I don't think you were coming. I think you came into the meatball shop, but it wasn't what was it for?
I think I went to your like opening night.
And, was it opening night?
I think I went. I think someone from your PR team invited me in, and I met you and
maybe
Mike.
Sarah Abel.
Yeah, Sarah, my old neighbor. Yeah, Sable. She invited it in. That was like a while ago, and then we've been in the same circles for a while.
I remember regarding the writing, talking to you 6 or 7 years or 8 years ago and saying like, you know, I really, really would love to have a column for the New York Times where I just give my opinion. And you were so kind when you said, you know, well, you know, I think that a lot of journalists work really hard and take their careers seriously. And so if you were interested in something like that, I don't think that's out of reason, but you might want to start with, you know, like learning how to write and having some like level of respect for the fact that I went to school, worked my ass off.
Oh man, I didn't crush it like that. We came to a compromise and we were able to work our kind of collaboration, and you develop, I write, you write,
I'm learning how to write, which is an awesome skill that is I'm proud and excited about, and also is so much harder than I give it credit. It's so much easier to read. I feel like reading, you just
I know.
No problem. Especially now that they've got those audiobooks. It's nothing.
I actually consider that reading. Is that wrong of me?
A lot of people give me grief and they tell me you didn't read that book. And, you know, I remember in school where there were auditory and visual learners. And if I absorb the information I can't imagine the author is upset at me for how I, you know, respected their work.
Yeah, it could be through the spoken word.
And I think that, like, especially in New York, how much time do you spend walking from to? And that time could be spent, you know,
also, quote unquote, reading.
Not to mention, you can multitask Candy Crush with Audible books and just get so much more done.
I agree. We read a column for Taste called 100 Questions for My Friend the Chef. You've appeared on the podcast in the podcast version of the column. But we write, like, you know, pretty regularly. It depends on our mood and our whims when we get it out there. But what do you want to do with this column? Like, what's your goal?
My ultimate dream would be to have all of the cooking questions answered in a database, and ideally in a print form where someone could have, like, a beautiful book that could be a reference volume, a tome. Tome.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And then I think something really beautiful that people, and I don't mean beautiful in, like, the California Venice, like, you know, oh, it's so beautiful. I meant it like in an actually like a beautifully produced work of,
yeah, like a really
manufactory
beautiful.
I went to a restaurant in San Francisco the other day called Tartine Manufactory.
Oh, I love that place.
It's amazing.
Yeah, Liz Pruitt, shout out. She's great.
What I love about that is it's like, you know, there was like provisions, and now it's manufactory.
Manufactory.
It's a cool word, and I was like, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, but let's talk about you moving to LA. Like, first off, I want to know, like, how's it like living here in January?
In all fairness, I moved to LA in November, and I've been here for 2.5 something months, but I've been away for like 5 of those weeks. So I haven't really gotten, so I'm still kind of, I can't really speak to the lifestyle of LA with great authority. I can say so far, it's awesome. And I'm so happy and excited. It's a little bit of a shock. It's like when you're driving downhill and you just gotta shift the gears a little bit and get used to the lifestyle. I'm very intense for Los Angeles.
You're very intense. Okay.
I think I'm not laid back for New York, but I'm certainly not the most intense New Yorker.
No.
But in LA, I'm a little intense. So I've had to give it a little bit of a slowdown, and to appreciate, you know, stop and smell the roses. There's an efficiency to life out here that allows you to have more time in your day, which is lovely.
It seems that way. It seems like there's definitely a little bit more presence and mindfulness, to use incredible buzzwords that I hate to use, but I'm being specific because I think it's true. People are more mindful here.
I feel like if you are a New Yorker, the thing that you know, if you were going to say something negative about LA, you'd speak to the people. You'd say like, oh, but those people. And the most shocking thing that I found is, in the whole time I've been here, I've met like tons of awesome people that I've got really some already meaningful relationships, and I'm looking forward to more of that.
But let's be real. You've lived here before. It's not like you've only been in LA for a few months. Like, tell me a little bit about your history with LA and San Francisco, working in professional kitchens, and then we can go back a little further to New York. But I want to hear about LA first.
So I moved to Los Angeles from Las Vegas when I was, I think, 19 or 20 years old. And my big brother was living in California, and I had lost my job in Vegas, and he said, come out to, I think it was actually the line from Die Hard. It's like, come out to the coast, have a few laughs. And I got in my car in 19 something, I don't know. Oh, maybe it was motorcycle, I don't remember.
We're
got
talking out. About in the 90s.
It was the 90s. It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Real Spicoli. And I moved out here, and it was the first time in my life that I decided to move away from being in a 4-star French restaurant. I got a job at a restaurant called Axe, which was a...
Which is called AXE.
Which is
called, like, in the English language, it's Axe.
Yeah, but I think this is like the like, I don't know, Ethiopian word for like love power or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very hippied out. And in all fairness, also really very delicious.
Listener, Google Axe Venice, and you'll find some cool stories about it for sure.
The lady who owned it, Joanna, had really great taste, and the restaurant was really, really delicious. And I went there as a cook, and I got a job as she made me the chef like 3 weeks in. I think she was having a hard time kind
she was
of
desperate
like
for
keeping
talent.
A chef. And, yeah. And I came across and wasn't my intention to be the chef there, but, I had a really awesome time. And it was interesting, 'cause it was the first time I got to appreciate rustic or kind of less formal food, if that makes sense.
Definitely.
And realize that it doesn't, there's, you know, I guess at the time, great restaurants were fancy restaurants only. And so it was early on in the evolution of kind of like casual dining.
And I want to backtrack a little bit. You grew up in Manhattan on the Upper East Side, and you delivered food as a kid. That was one of your first jobs in food. You were a delivery...
Delivery boy, I believe. Give me a good those.
Delivery boy, yeah.
Yeah. Delivery when they're boy. When they're my when they're young. Gender, they call them delivery boys.
Delivery boys. But you have crazy delivery stories. Give me a good one.
So, in all fairness, like, every single... There was not... I always dreamed of that moment that you see in the traditional porno where the delivery boy shows up and, you know, she's in her bathrobe. That never happened. And, you know, I extended my delivery career as long as I could in hopes that that would be, that was like the pinnacle that never, yeah. that I aspired to this apex and never, anyway. Unfortunately, the craziest thing I can say is that I played the harmonica at the time, and I would walk down the street playing the harmonica.
Real blues traveler fan.
I was not a big Dave Matthews guy.
Blues Traveler?
But was Dave Matthews the Blues Traveler? Or are they different?
Two separate bands.
Did they both feature harmonica? They both
featured the harmonica. I was going more Blues Traveler because, you know, Blues Traveler featured the harmonica during the mid-90s. But
who was the guy with the curly hair and, like, the poetic guy that he played the harmonica also?
John Popper from Blues Traveler?
No, Bob Dylan.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ha.
Hey.
Hey.
Ba-da-dum. So, I don't have any... But I did have a lot of seminal experiences as a delivery boy. I started out when I was very young, like 11 years old, delivering pizzas for the neighborhood. It was the first time I ever saw pornographic materials at the pizzeria.
Yeah.
And that was big and exciting for me. I was 11 or 12, and it was a real discovery.
It felt like a Playboy.
No, they had it on the TV. I think it was like Channel J. It was,
oh, my gosh.
They had Channel 1 through 32, A through U, and like J. And Channel J, I think it was like Robin Bird.
Oh, yeah, Robin Bird. Shout out. Everyone knows Robin Bird.
Also, there was a bunch of commercials. Yeah. It was pretty special.
But what about, like, just delivering food, like, too? Like, I feel like there's some other, like, crazy shit you saw.
Unfortunately, again, like, you know, I know a lot of friends of mine that delivered food and other things. It's like organic food and pot or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was a pretty conservative guy, and I just delivered for the dough. I wanted the tips.
So you eventually landed after your delivery career.
Delivery days.
Delivery days.
The salad days.
The salad days. Things got kind of real after the salad days. You ended up working at Le Bernardin.
Le Bernardin.
Le Bernardin.
Le Bernardin.
For Eric Repair. So tell me about that. I mean, you're 17 years old.
So at the time I was 14 and a half or something like that. I was working at a restaurant called Samolita's. It was a... No, that was my first job. I was working at the Candle Cafe.
Candle,
for Joy and Bart.
Yeah.
Still there, and a testament to vegan food and the vegan lifestyle, because they two of them look exactly the same 20 years later. It's incredible. I think either they're vampires or it's a real thing, this raw vegan healthful diet. And they're lovely people, and their restaurant is still there and really good. And I was delivering food, and I was into the kitchen. There was something about the machismo of the tattoos and the fire and the guys in the kitchen. And so I would work in the kitchen, kind of between deliveries. And a friend of mine, her father was a maitre d' of Le Bernardin. And he came into the restaurant. Her mother had come into the restaurant. He offered to bring me into Le Bernardin to meet Eric.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 14.
So you weren't, man, 14. 14, jeez.
Go into the restaurant kitchen, after school on a Wednesday. I had a 3 o'clock appointment. I get off school at 3. I show up at 3:30. He shows up at 3:45 and he goes, "You are late?" And I was like, he goes, "Luckily I was taking a haircut, so I won't penalize you this time. You have a job." The French don't pronounce H's. I don't know. They have a job. And that was incredible. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't even understand. We didn't go out to restaurants as a kid. Like, I went out to restaurant 2 or 3 times a year. Although my father's visitation rights did auspiciously coincide with Dollar Whopper night at Burger King. So we did sometimes find ourselves at Burger King.
Yeah.
That's not a joke. I mean, it's funny.
No, it's real. You told me that story several times. I know your Dollar Whopper with dad.
Yeah, it was special. My father's actually a wonderful, loving guy.
That's going to be a personal essay to my Dollar Whopper with dad.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to happen.
Dollar Whopper with dad.
Yeah.
The It's all about that special sauce. And flame broiled. And you're away right away. It wasn't yet, but they still gave that.
Yeah.
So the Eric and La Bernadette was after school on Wednesdays and summers. Wow. And it was something I didn't understand it all, but I got a lot of positive feedback. You know, people would say, oh my gosh, you work at this incredible restaurant. And, you know, they had so much to say that I think that gave, you know, made me want more of that. It was the positive feedback cycle.
What were you doing? Like, as a 14-year-old, having not gone to culinary school, having done some delivery, like, were you working in the kitchen? What were you?
First job was, at the time when they built the restaurant, I don't think refrigeration was quite as advanced. And so they kept the fish away from the fire on the separate side of the restaurant. And my job was actually called the fish pass. My job was to take the fish from the refrigerator and bring it to the person that would cook it. I also cleaned calamari. Mm. I was the squid kid.
God.
Or my dad called me the squid yid. and I cleaned 50 pounds of calamari a day. And I had a really cute story actually one time, which was I went in the calamari. I guess there were some calamari that had maybe been questionable freshness that had been mixed in somehow to a batch. And they had said, you know, like Eric was like, you need to smell every piece. And I went into the office at some point and I interrupted and I said, you know, chef, I've smelled every single piece. And he goes, I know, look in the mirror. And my nose was stained black from the squid ink. It was really cute. I could only imagine this curly haired, you know, cherub.
Yeah.
That I was still.
But Eric, I mean, he's had his ups and downs with temper and he's clearly pulled his shit together. But now being a Buddhist, he's was on our podcast, like how many, like maybe in number 15 or something. So you can check it up, check back. But was he like pretty?
I think, wild? You know, I was there. So the original chef of La Bernadette was a guy named Gilbert Lacoste.
Of course.
And he passed away and Eric kind of rose quickly.
Suddenly, you know? He passed away. Like,
And Eric, he was intense, but I would say he was always really kind. The kitchen had a very strong kind of European militaristic structure that over the course of my like five-year tenure.
Sure.
Because it's not 10 years.
It's not 10 years, it's tenure. As a child, I would assume it would have been 10 years, but it's actually 10 years.
Just like when you go to the Five and Dime and it's not all nickels and dimes. It's some of it's real expensive.
Yeah.
I hate that.
That's true.
So over that course of that time, I did see a change. And it was, I think it was part of, you know, in the zeitgeist, the world was changing and people were understanding that positive reinforcement was a stronger motivator and a better management technique than
terror and fear.
but he also came from, you know, a school that was really ruled with an iron fist and helped to shepherd in the new, you know, I remember one day, Chris Muller, who's still the chef there, is amazing. Mm-hmm. He would call me a jack job. And that was my name. I was like, Jack Job.
Jack Job, yeah. Dan's a Jack Job, yeah.
And then one day, I remember Eric being like, we will no longer call him a Jack Job. And I was like, this is incredible. Apparently, I didn't have to do any better to get praise. I just continued to be a Jack Job, but I didn't, I don't know, deserve the moniker?
No, you...
I just want to use as many big words as possible because we're on the radio.
Let's continue with the French guy impression because you worked for Jean-Louis Palandin.
Incredible chef, Jean-Louis Palandin.
He is an absolute legend in the game of like fine dining and French restaurants in New York City and in Washington, D.C., right? He had restaurants in both.
He did a couple of things that were spectacular. First of all, he came over from France and he was one of the first French chefs to appreciate and utilize American ingredients and say like, you know, I'm going to use local ingredients in this French cuisine. So before him, it was celebration of the fact that you had white German asparagus that was canned asparagus in your restaurant because it was so hard to come by. He said, no, no, no. And he helped to teach a lot of people how to farm and how to fish. He, you know, day boat cod, diver scallops.
From Montauk.
From Montauk to Maine, you know, he helped to kind of like teach people, and he created a market for by saying to farmers, you know, if you can grow this, chef's toys, you know, if you can grow this, I'll buy it. And so really was a driving force. He also sponsored the visas of a lot of chefs. I think Danielle Belude, I know Eric, he sponsored their visa from France. So that was their first job in America, was coming to work for him. So he was really a larger than life character, really not a nutcase.
Yeah. So legendary, like the way he would write menus. You have a lot of his menus still in your files, which are really cool.
Huge heart, huge temper. He would pace back and forth and say, "It's the end of the world," which is my favorite part.
It's the end of the world. It's the end of the world. The end of the fucking world.
That was his, like, that was his, you know. And he would scream and shout and throw stuff. And I don't know. I responded really well to that. Yeah. I remember one day I had forgotten I was making duck confit, where you salt the duck and you kind of cure it, and then you cook it in its own fat, under fat, slowly. And I had left it on salt. So it's supposed to salt for like 12 hours. And I left the restaurant and I forgot. He also smoked Marlboro Reds on the line. It was a thing. And I forgot the duck. So I came back to the restaurant. I had a couple of drinks. I was young, like maybe 19 or something. Came back to the restaurant and I was sneaking in to take the duck off the salt. And who's there at 2 o'clock in the morning? Walks in while I'm like washing the duck off, but Jean-Louis. And I just about pooped my pants. And he goes, "What are you doing?" I was like, you know, explained to him, came clean, only choice. And he took one of the duck legs. I think he might have been inebriated. And he took a giant bite of the thing, raw duck, chewed it up, spit it out, and goes, "It's seasoned perfectly, go home." I was like, God bless, you know, the United States of America.
Jean-Louis, God, what great stories. And I think your career is so interesting to me. And when we write about food, I think a lot of our columns and just in general, when we write, like you recall these stories that you tell so coolly. So let's go to San Francisco.
Oof.
Let's get to that Dan Holtzman world, because you worked in some pretty iconic places up there. You were rising in the ranks. You became CDC chef de cuisine and like the head dude at a couple places. So what was that like a little bit?
So I moved from... I moved from Vegas to LA. I tried to get out of the restaurant business. It didn't work out terribly well for me. Restaurants like a pirate ship. Yeah. And the type of personality that works well in that kind of, you know, I don't know. It just, I'm not fit for regular, I don't know what the word for it is.
Office life.
9-to-5er.
Yeah.
And so I called Eric and I said, "I'm thinking about going to work in restaurants again." And he said, "If I were going to start over, if I had the choice, I would live in San Francisco. Best produce, best connection to farmers." And
this is Eric Repair's advice to you. Yeah.
And he said, I've got a guy who you should go work for. He's got the best, best food, you know, wonderful technique, delicious, delicious food. Laurent Monrique, who's still up there. And I went up to work for him. He was the chef at the Campton place at the time, right before Daniel Hume came in, after Bradley Ogden, I think. And, I went and worked for this guy, and he's this passionate cook, one of the best cooks I've ever worked with. Really, I learned so much about just cooking with your heart, I guess, from working with him. And Nate Appleman was a cook at the time, and we became very close friends. There was a guy named Chris that later on went to open A16 that then Nate took over for, which is a really kind of like seminal Italian pizza pasta place with Southern Italian wine that's really elevated and brought that pizza pasta concept to the next level, and regional Italian food. So I made some really great connections, actually really kind of special time.
Yeah.
And then I called after a year, I called Eric up and I said, you know, and he said, "Well, you know, there's one guy in San Francisco that's cooking the best technique of anybody out there. This guy named Laurent Gras. He was this young, kind of like wonder kid.
Yeah. He was a genius
from France, who had worked for, who's a super famous guy with all the Michelin stars, Alain Ducasse.
Yeah, Ducasse.
And he was like the youngest 3 Michelin star chef. He was the chef of Alain Ducasse in Monaco and He had such a funny story, actually. I worked for him. He didn't have a huge sense of humor about his work. He was very serious about his work. And his technique was absolutely impeccable. He was doing stuff that was so extraordinary and some of the most individually delicious ingredients I've ever come across. Really, really special. And stuff that you could, way, way, way before his time, he was sous vide-ing short ribs and cooking them for, 72 hours. So they were fully braised, but medium rare. It's just cool stuff.
Really influential. Does it bum you out that we don't know in Food Mia in 2019, the Laurents, we don't know Laurent Manrique, Laurent Gras. We don't talk about Jean-Louis Palandin. These are names that are so important to cooking, but ultimately they've been forgotten in many ways, I feel, in this very quick moving culture.
I don't, so much know that any of them or anybody else should care from their ego perspective. But certainly there was a lot to learn and a lot going on in that time, a lot of experimentation with food that I think is being reinvented now and rediscovered now. And maybe some credit is going to folks for cooking food in a way that has been cooked before, which is what it is. But, there's something about and we've talked about this a lot, mm-hmm. about the old apprenticeship system mm-hmm. where cooks, and I think... I saw Jacques Pepin. Oh, you were with me.
Yeah.
That was amazing at MAD.
At MAD in Copenhagen, yeah.
Jacques Pepin talked about, the apprenticeship system and in order to be, to learn a craft, it's however many thousand hours of work, an apprenticeship and practice, and their craftsmanship becomes before artistry. And that was really well said. And it's a little bit lost, and so folks that don't have a full blown grasp of the craft are discovering stuff that's like that other people might have and taking maybe credit for, and even the press might be giving credit for stuff that might not really be a new thing.
Yeah, it's a tough situation, old versus new, and the changing dynamics and generations.
Evolution isn't something we're going to fight against. We're not going to win that one.
Really. Really,
the turtles are not coming back.
People. Sage of you,
forget your straw.
We went there.
Use your straw, people. The turtles ain't coming back. Okay. Galapagos, I'm coming. Imagine the size of straws you could carve from a Galapagos turtle shell.
Let's go back to New York, because after San Francisco, you ended up back in New York.
Tortoise shell, sorry.
Tortoise. You ended up back in New York, but you kind of changed roles a bit. You went from being a chef working the line to actually being a business owner. And I really want to ask you this question, because I've wondered. I don't think I've ever asked you this. Like, you and your partner Mike really, really succeeded with this concept, meatballs, that honestly were fucking there, hiding in plain sight. Like, meatballs. Like, we know that New York City has a robust a Little Italy. Italian meatballs, like everyone knows meatball SpaghettiOs, but like no one had really innovated the meatball in a restaurant and built a restaurant around it. So like, tell me, like, why did that work so well?
Well, I've done a lot of media training on this subject.
Because we're all about the media trained response in the Taste Podcast.
I just remember like Phil Baltz and Sarah Abel, who are the publicists of the meatball shop and absolutely excellent people who are, really talented, saying like, you're going to tell people that, you're going to elevate and give a pedestal to meatballs and put them on the same platform that pizza and burgers have had for years. And the single restaurant concept isn't something you've invented, but you're elevating.
Oh my God, you just used radio announcer voice. So let's actually cut the bullshit.
So I think that we got really lucky, because it was an economic downturn. There were not a lot of restaurants opening. And
what year is this?
This is 2010. February of 2010 we opened. February 9th, 2010. We took the lease right before Thanksgiving. Is this illegal to say? I don't even know if I get in trouble for this. Nothing's illegal to say. This is America.
It's a safe place.
But when you admit something you've done that's illegal, I don't know if you get in trouble for it. We built the restaurant without the permits at all. But then we had applied for permits. And then the day that we were ready to open the restaurant, the permits showed up. And I was like, I was, really nervous. But it worked out. No one got hurt, thankfully.
Is that so? Like, should people follow that?
Absolutely not. You should not do that. there's huge liability, big stake. But you don't really know what you can lose when you don't have anything to lose until you, you know, realize, ooh, I could have lost a lot.
Yeah.
That would have been terrible.
So let's, you open on the Lower East Side in 2010. You open the meatball stop.
So what I was saying is that it was an economic downturn. Sorry, am I talking too much?
I love
it. You are interviewing me. Is that okay?
I'm interviewing you, Dan. We're going long.
I think I drank Phil's coffee, which is a lot. It's got a lot of energy. Very delicious. Yeah. Only drip. None of that.
It's good stuff. Phil's is great.
So it was an economic downturn. So not a lot of restaurants were opening. And then we wanted to have a really inexpensive, fairly priced restaurant. I felt like I was cooking for people that my friends and family couldn't afford to eat in the restaurants that I was cooking. And I felt strange charging $24 at the time. Now it seems reasonable to spend to charge $20 for a bowl of pasta. At the time, it seemed really kind of rude. And so this whole idea of like, we're going to open a casual restaurant where we serve the same quality food using the same ingredients for a fraction of the price, drive volume, make a place to work that's a fun place to work, even though it's got good food. It really resonated. And the press didn't have a lot to talk about. And I feel like the story of two best friends opening a restaurant together is something that people can get behind. I think many of us over the years have talked with our best friend about having a business together. And so that was something that people got excited about and they talked about it. And because nothing else was opening, they kept on talking about it. And because the news cycle was fairly bleak, we were, you know, something that people got, and it really resonated. It was awesome.
Yeah. You had lines, I remember, in the first couple months, and people really, and you started opening more locations.
We really struck while the iron's hot. We struck ourselves in the face with the iron. That was,
is that a cooking metaphor, or is that more like an industry metaphor? Like
striking while the iron's hot?
Yeah.
I think that it's an, I've always thought it was an ironing metaphor. Like you press your pants, like you don't want to, your pants won't get unwrinkled unless you, that's what I thought, but I'm sure I'm wrong.
I think of like Billy Joel Allentown, like the, like banging of metal, like smelting.
It's impossible for me to hear somebody speak the word Billy Joel in Allentown, not
woo. Bottle of
I love
red,
that song.
Bottle of
wine. No.
So back to the Italian
That's
restaurant.
That's not my karaoke song, but it could be.
Back to the Italian restaurant. So you're opening lots of locations. You're expanding. And tell me, what's the story? How has the story evolved?
So, you know, we had a lot of chutzpah. It's a Yiddish word. I think it means moxie. Which is a Yiddish word, which means chutzpah. we definitely moved. Luckily, I think we moved faster than we knew how. We had confidence beyond our actual scope of our real knowledge and ability. But we opened the restaurants and people came and they were successful. And, you know, as we opened about one a year, which folks were telling us we weren't moving fast enough. It's weird. When you're looking forward, it feels really fast. It's kind of like when you're, I don't know if you've ever jumped off a cliff into the water. When you look from the top, it looks really tall. And then when you get down there, you're like, it wasn't that bad. Well, it feels really like you're on a big wave when you're opening the restaurants. The business evolved really quickly because it's constantly changing as it's growing. We had a lot of, the restaurant community is extremely kind and wonderful. Like we had tons of great advice from people. I mean, I don't know another industry where people from other restaurants, not competing, but other restaurants just came and just gave us tons of advice. I mean, like real bigwigs.
Give the names because we should shout it out.
Richard Corrine from Union Square Hospitality would sit down with us and give us just, you know, was a real mentor. We would not have been able to do without him. We met with Ron Sage from Panera Bread, who was like just sat down with us and gave us tons of kind of like his time, and was somebody that was available by phone for us to, you know, run questions by. The guy that started Pan Quotidien sat down with us.
His name was Laurent.
He was really, really helpful. And, you know, what was interesting is all these people that really, really know, you know, you can't open a restaurant and assume you're going to know more than someone that has thousands of restaurants ever. Otherwise, you're an idiot. Hopefully, I'm not a complete idiot. So what we did was, there were a lot of things that all these guys agreed on. And if everybody agreed on something, we did it. We were like, we don't mess with that. And then when they disagreed, you realize, oh, like, you know, for instance, the expansion. Somebody says, you know, the guy from Cheesecake Factory was another one that started Cheesecake Factory. He said, you know, look, like, you know, you can either grow in concentric circles or you can open one in New York and one in San Francisco, then one in Texas. And which is the best way to do it? All those guys argued over that. And we thought, well, if everybody's arguing over that, then there's no best way. It's whatever fits best for us.
The Cheesecake Factory guy, did he give you free cheesecake?
Absolutely not. But can I tell you that, have you had that cheesecake? It's very delicious.
I've been to the mall. Yes, I've had
it. It's very delicious. And, you know, one thing that, working in fancy restaurants, I was a little bit of a snob about chain restaurants.
Oh, really?
And I didn't appreciate how much harder it is to have multiple consistent good quality restaurants than it is to have one. One restaurant, good quality, requires one great manager passionately overseeing it. Multiple restaurants require brains and operational ability and all kinds of other, you know, it's tough.
So Meatball Shop has gone on to open in Washington, D.C., and it's thriving, absolutely thriving. I want to ask you about another project you're working on.
Oh, my gosh.
In San Francisco, in Oakland, with Kyle Atani of Hopscotch. Love Kyle. You guys run Atani Ramen. Well, Kyle runs it day-to-day, and you're part of the project. Like, what got you involved with ramen, and where do you want to see this go? I just think it's such a cool idea.
So I'm a silent partner in a restaurant called Atani Ramen, which means that I am not officially involved in any capacity other than silently and not telling anybody about it. However, in real life, Kyle and I before he opened his first restaurant, Hopscotch, which is an awesome restaurant in Oakland.
It's innovative. It's a magical place.
His then fiance, now wife and mother of his beautiful daughter, was going to school in New York, master's degree. She's a genius, actually. She's amazing. And he had some time between jobs and came and helped us open a restaurant in New York. He was friends with the executive chef of the Meatball Shop, Daniel Sharp. And subsequently, we've become really close friends. We've traveled to Japan together a couple of times. You know, we've done lots of food festivals together, and we've just really enjoyed working together. He came to me and said, I want to do a second restaurant. And, you know, I said, listen, whenever we've gone to Japan, you've been so passionate about ramen. You love ramen. He loved the idea that so much of in Japan is so structured and there's so much formality around everything people don't have an ability to really express themselves artistically that freely. But because ramen isn't traditionally Japanese, it's Chinese, there's tons of room for artistic kind of freedom outside of the cultural constraints. And so you see in every prefecture around Japan, people opening ramen restaurants that are unique and special and highlighting ingredients. And there's a lot of evolution kind of happening quickly. And I was like, you know, that's a unique perspective. In America, like, I didn't know ramen was anything other than like this tonkatsu thick pork broth. Like, I didn't realize it. Now, you know, like, look, Lucky Peach's first issue was like all the ramen. So now we know that. But at the time, it was really special, and I was learning so much from him that I said, I think you should open a ramen restaurant. And so, he put an incredible plan together and a menu, and it's been evolving. And there's an izakaya. It's so amazing. Like, at the time we were talking about izakaya, like, how are people going to call it? Cause no one knows what that is. Now it's like, everybody understands.
It's vernacular,
like,
now. Yeah.
Tapas gastropub Japanese style. Great. And that restaurant has been doing really, really, really well. It's so nice to watch it. And I was up there a few weeks ago, and the food is better than it's ever been.
Yeah, I was there in November, and I had a really, really great... I think I had a shoyu broth. Ooh, I don't think I had any of the tonkatsu. Wait, does he do tonkatsu?
Yeah, so the menu basically has... it does have a rich pork broth, like, you know, tonkatsu. Yeah. And then he's got a shio, a shoyu, you know, like a salt and a soy.
Yeah.
And then he's got a couple of vegetarian. He's got a buttered mushroom.
Yeah, that's great.
And there's something about making a vegetarian broth have the weight of ramen that requires a level of, you know, who does it really? Have you had that vegan Ramen Hood? The vegan,
yeah, Robin Hood.
I think it's absolutely. I think it's absolutely.
Yeah,
excellent.
At the Grand Central.
Elon
here
Hall
in LA.
Is like, I think he's a really good human being and a lovely.
Yeah,
person.
Yeah, cool. Yeah,
and I think his food's excellent.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Yeah, Robin Hood's cool.
Yeah,
I love it. I want
a cool name.
You know, come on, like shout out.
I mean, not that the Gorbals. What is what does the Gorbals even mean?
I mean,
Robin Hood, Elon
Gorbals. Yeah,
you're really you're robbing from the rich and you're giving.
Were you ever on that show that he did?
Yes, Knife Fight. I lost.
You were on. You lost on Knife Fight.
I've lost at every competition show I've ever.
Yeah,
been
which
on.
Ones have you done? You done? A few
I don't. Ones. I've done Beat Bobby Flay.
So Bobby Flay beat your ass.
No, I lost in the first round to a chef, an Indian woman, Palak, Patel, I believe, who's awesome, and she was really talented. And then she went on to beat Bobby Flay.
Oh, good.
And she's also like couldn't be more sweet and. It was fun.
So you lost on that. You lost on Knife Fight.
I've lost on. I'm not a fast cook. I'm just not. I'm not into like. If you tell me make the best thing you can make in 15 minutes, I'm like, I'd rather take 30 minutes and make the best thing I can make in as much time as I got. Like, it just isn't my style. And you know, also, my problem I think is that one bite. The judges take one bite, and I cook for a whole plate, not one big.
Sounds
flavorful
like,
bite.
That sounds like the words of a guy who lost twice on competition show.
Yeah, I got a lot of... basically, I just lost.
Cause you basically, yeah.
The other reason that I lost, let me give you my other excuse.
Your food.
I didn't season the
you lost
the
your
aubergine.
Scallops.
I didn't season the aubergine.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's European for...
eggplant. I want to know, okay, we're in LA now. We talked about your move here. Oof. I mean, what are you doing here? Are you gonna maybe jump back in?
Smoke lots of pot, do some surfing, bro.
Yeah, man.
I was thinking about finger painting as a new, like finger painting clinic and Reiki.
Oh, that's cool. Reiki's great.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Also, have you seen elephants paint before? Because it's a real thing and you should look it up on YouTube. I've been spending a lot of time on the YouTube rabbit hole watching elephants paint. In real life, I want to open a restaurant. And I didn't know if I wanted to open a restaurant. But working at the meatball shop really did evolve into more of a management job. And I challenged myself to be an executive, which I don't think I am naturally suited to. But I do feel like I learned a lot about, and I have a great deal of respect for the understanding of bureaucracy and the fact that bureaucracy doesn't necessarily have to be a bad word. It can mean, you know, if you set up a bureaucracy to drive a culture and an environment that is positive, then it can do wonderful things. And also bureaucracy is what's stopping the people that aren't necessarily great at thinking on their feet from, you know, crashing their cars all the time into you, killing you. So thankfully. So that was amazing. But I would really love to get behind the stove. I've been going to the farmer's market. I've been cooking a lot.
Yeah.
Los Angeles is not known for having the best vegetables in America. But when you go to the farmer's market, it's the best farmer's market in America.
It's the best farms.
It's just, you know, there's something about the freeway access, I guess, makes it so that you can...
From Central California you're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, like you can go... It's the San Francisco Farmers Market is absolutely spectacular.
You have fucking sun here, you man. Know, you have a lot of sun and you have an ocean with...
Cool it's just, this food. Is where like 20% of the food in America gets grown. Yeah. And, you know, for a great example is like, I bought radishes at the farmer's market last Wednesday, so they're 10 days old. I don't know if you ever bought radishes in a supermarket in New York, but like they last 3 days and they get soggy. I pulled one out of my fridge today and it's crispy as can be because a radish's shelf life is actually probably like 14 days.
We've never seen it.
But I've never seen a radish that was 1 day old. You know, the vegetables really are extraordinary here.
We ask everyone on the Taste Podcast, what, Dan Holzman, is your dream cookbook project?
My dream cookbook project would be, in real life, I would like to go with my friend Matt Rodbard on the Siberian Express, Trans-Siberian Express from Moscow to Beijing. And I'd like to get off at every stop that makes sense for us to get off at. And I'd love to cook with a grandma on every single stop and document a recipe from that region. I think that would be very cool. And then I looked up, and in true like Russian crazy bureaucratic, if you get off the Trans-Siberian Express, you can't get on the next one without a ticket, and you have to book your ticket from that stop to the your terminus stop. And like, if you don't get on that specific train, you're just out there. So you could like get off in like, you know, Kazakhstan. I don't even know where that is, but I imagine it's cold. And you're just like SOL. They don't let you back on that train. Period.
But we're going to go Gonzo style. We're just going to like make it work.
Yeah, I don't think you make it work in Russia. I think you get buried. I think you turn into mulch.
This outline is really kind of coming together right now that we have.
Like, but isn't that a cool idea?
I love that idea. We've talked about some travel books.
We talked about doing doing China.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much, you know, regional China. There's so much out there that hasn't been explored. There's so much great cuisine in the world.
Yeah.
The Caucasus.
Yeah, I know.
I'm a big guy for the Caucasus.
Yeah, it's cool stuff.
Into it. There's so much great food.
I know. And how undiscovered.
About like Chile? The Chinese influence of Chile. Like Chilean food, and you know, that's cool.
I'm into these ideas, Daniel Holzman. Thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
I want to thank you for coming all the way out to Los Angeles and being here with me today.
Here's Matt talking to Ted and Matt Lee.
Matt Lee, Ted Lee, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Oh, man, we're
Thanks
so excited
for having
to be
us,
here.
Matt.
It's so great to see you guys. I usually see you in Charleston. I usually see you down there.
We're usually like gnawing on a drumstick or something or shrimp tail.
I love it. But let's talk about catering. This book, Hotbox, is really cool because you've done the Bill Buford Heat thing before for catering.
I mean,
yeah, thank you for mentioning that. That was sort of a guiding text. You know, it was a comparative title that we always thought about.
And Ted, I wanted to ask you. You know, catering, it's this $12 billion business annually, but we as food writers in the food media, we don't talk about it that often. And I wanted to know, how does it affect our lives in these unique ways?
Well, I mean, the first thing to understand is catering. You know, big C catering is everywhere. It's like, you know, it's corporate cafeterias. It's the kind of catering that we did goes by the name of off-premise catering or special events catering. And it's kind of a different ball of wax because it's all about delivering food to venues that don't have kitchens. So it's like adding a food service function in spaces where a kitchen doesn't exist. So there's no running water typically. There's no electricity. There's no HVAC. And you have to move the kitchen with you. So, I mean, how does catering interact with people's lives in so many ways? But if you've ever been to a bat mitzvah, quinceañera, you know,
wedding.
A wedding, you know, there's so many ways in which if you've ever been to a celebration, a party where there's been catered food, it's
the slang term some people use inside the industry is meals on wheels. It's like it's simply that idea that food moves from place to place. Once you do that, a lot of weird things happen to destabilize the quality, the potential quality of the food that's being received on the other end. And it wasn't until we embedded in this system, especially in New York City, where the stakes are just that much higher and the conditions are that much worse, that we realized what we had here. I mean, it's a subculture, a large one, hiding in plain sight for most people.
I mean, it creates great drama. I mean, we're talking about bringing food for between 500 and, or 50 and 1700 to the weird spaces that you would unexpect, that are unexpected.
With the people we were working with every night, for them, a small party is 350. So that's small.
And the spaces we're talking
about, and a large party is 12.
The spaces we're talking about, just to try to create an image, are the Temple of Dendur is the classic one. And one of the earlier ones that was attempted in the early 70s in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's just a museum gallery, you know, a dusty old museum. Like, there's nothing going on in there. So if you're bringing a kitchen there, you're setting up in a loading dock or behind a curtain in a hallway. What are some other classic venues? The Javits Center. It's like a cement slab. You know, yeah. And it's cold.
And it's an airplane hangar, basically. And then you have to move within that. You have to construct your kitchen.
You write about pipe and drape, which is the yes. kind of the vernacular of the kitchen or the caterer's
exactly.
kitchen.
Exactly. The
right?
pipe and drape is that thing that shields the kitchen from the floor of the party. And
there are all these layers of invisibility in catering. And it's part of why people just don't really know about it unless they've worked in it. And it's why we were really keen on telling the tale, because it's so shrouded.
And Matt, tell me, I we hear the word catering, and mm-hmm. it's a pejorative term. The yeah. food is mm-hmm. considered rubber chicken. Is this your opinion at the end of all this reporting, or is there something else to this story about the quality of the food?
Absolutely not. I mean, that is the sort of classic instinctual thing. I mean, we had that same feeling initially. You know, how can the quality not suffer if you're serving 1,700 people in a grassy field? But what we discovered is that the people who dwell in this world are, you know, hyper-skilled, hyper-specialized because they have to be. If you aren't, you get stripped from the system pretty cleanly and pretty quickly. It's just incredible, the strategies, the vocabulary, the tools, the food torture, we call it, that they do. It's so different from restaurant world and from home cooking, mm-hmm. just entirely different.
And Ted, give us some examples of some of the dishes that
you know, at the level of catering that we're doing, pretty much every past appetizer has like at least 4 or 5 or 6 or even 7 elements. So it's really, you know, it's like curried chicken papadum with curry leaf, you know,
orange and achiote.
Achiote. Yeah. It's like, and there's 13 past apps.
Yeah.
And so there's 7 elements to each one of those past apps. So it's not, you know, there's a lot going on and there's a lot to, you know, pay attention to. I will say that, you know, in the larger the party, the more sort of conventional the proteins. The ones that are super popular in the New York area are short rib and lamb shank because they hold brilliantly, right?
In fact, they improve with a little age on them in the cooler.
Right. So so a typical seated plated dinner would be like short rib with some kind of spatzel and some kind of vegetable. And usually a green, like winter greens or something.
A sauce and a garnish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a sauce and a garnish.
But like, think of it, the restaurant chef is in her own like space, like her station all tricked out, that got the mise en place, has spent, you know, 3 hours like prepping that. Mm-hmm. And it's the same from night to night. So it's a comfort zone. Yeah. From night to night, a catering chef might not have ever seen the kitchen that they're going to be setting up in. And inevitably is handing the plates, the perfect plates that you planned out 9 months ago, to a stranger.
And in enters the hot box, which is your title of your book, and also mm-hmm. you trace the history of this piece of machinery that has revolutionized the way catering works. Explain what a hot box does and is, and how it is the lifeblood of a catering kitchen.
So a hot box is what a lot of people across the country call a transport cabinet. It's the aluminum, about 5.5 feet tall, on casters, aluminum cabinet that transports sheet pans of food, you know, from one end of the kitchen to the other or some such.
That's it. And what we discovered delving into the history is that back in the 1970s, this French chef, Jean-Claude Nedelec, was a banquet chef at the Plaza Hotel. He hacked this transport cabinet by inserting a couple sheet pans with just a cluster of Sternos on them, mm-hmm. you know, that mm-hmm. alcohol gel fuel. He could put a few of those in there, intermixed among the salmon fillets, and he could commendably turn this thing into an oven. The problem is, I guess, is that there's no temperature gauge, so you have to have pure wits and experience. You have to have logged thousands of hours touching this thing to know how to do it right. and to crack the door open a little bit to admit oxygen, but not so far that it loses heat. Right. I mean, it's an insanely analog system. It's like flying a hot air balloon compared to like driving a plane. And it's still being used today.
Yeah.
It turns out to be insanely flexible.
You know, it does function as a warming oven principally, because most of the food is par cooked. You know, your proteins get seared
back at the production kitchen. That's
the story right there of how you actually use a hot box to cook, because it's like you have to par cook at a certain temperature. If you go over in your par cooking, you're going to have rubber.
Right.
But if you go under, you're going to have raw, and that's obviously very unsafe. So,
and the other thing to consider is that, you know, Matt was mentioning the restaurant chef with her mise en place. Most of the fiesta shift, like the party shift cooks who come in on the party, they're receiving a mise en place that's been created for them
by other cooks.
And they're their first job is to unpack all the coolers and dry packs and all that kind of stuff.
There's this disconnect between the prep kitchen and the fiesta kitchen.
What happens if you open that thing of a mint and it's all like, you know, slime? It's like, what do you do?
And you're like on an island. You're literally on
Liberty Island, or you're out in the Hamptons or whatever.
Yeah, there's rarely the chance for a rerun, which is that kind of like we fudged it thing.
Did you ever see that though? Like a run out to like the sea town?
All the time.
Yes.
Dude, oh my God. And you know, and what's cool is that in the Hamptons, you might be able to go to a farmer's market, but also you have to remember in the Hamptons, the traffic on weekends is insane. And so that rerun could take you a 2-hour round trip, which you might have if you got there on time, but you're going out to the Hamptons on the weekend, so you're always running late, you're always behind the eight ball. So
one important takeaway we got as home, because we are home cooks, you know,
You've written several cookbooks, are
written from a home cook's perspective. We've never worked in restaurants. But what the result of this research has done for our home kitchen practice is that we've just gotten much more comfortable doing a lot of prep, even 1-2 days ahead of time, and just being, you know, happy with that burnished, you know, protein sitting in the fridge. Mm-hmm. And think about what it does to, you know, the day that you have your dinner party. It just makes you so much more relaxed. You're not schvitzing into the sauce. It's just a lot nicer.
And your guests don't see you sweating and laboring, and because they don't want to. They don't want to see you work. They want to spend time with you.
It's the sign of a great host when the host is present, and then the out pops his meal. It's like 3 courses effortlessly. I want to hear about stress and chaos and war stories. And I guess, Ted, give an example of a really bad scene that played out that you witnessed.
Oh my gosh, this is a classic one. I mean, the NBA Legends brunch for 1,400 people at the Javits Center.
Including NBA Legends.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, mind you, it was a buffet. So, you know, the kitchen never spends time on the floor. So whoever the celebrities are out there, unless there's a tasting station, we didn't see them. But behind the scenes, you know, our call time was 5:30 a.m. It was freezing cold that morning. And I watched one of the guys in sanitation had again, it's 1,400 people. And that was one where I was like, my head chef, my lead chef, I was throwing down my backpack, my coat, hanging up my coat on the thing. And I was like, chef, should I bring my knife kit? And he's like, I don't know. Is one of them a shovel? You know, because it was like, we were just getting
ready.
The volume of food was so insane.
Bring your shovel.
So there was this guy on the sanitation team who was somehow charged with rolling 6 glassware racks full of yogurt parfaits. It's brunch, like yogurt parfaits. Down the hall of the Javits Center, and I'm looking at it, and there's like an electrical cable running across, and he thinks this thing is gonna jump the cable. It doesn't. It stops short, and you're watching 6, you know, it's like, you know, 3 foot, 4 foot tall, just go.
There might have been 700 parfaits.
I mean, 700 or 800 parfaits, and lost all in the space of
and glass.
And that wasn't even our kitchen team. That was the sanitation guy. It was so funny.
Here's the thing about these events is that you instinctually know, but let me remind you, hovering over most catered events is this expectation that everyone be served at the same time, no matter how big the event is, within about 10 or 15 minutes. Because if one side of the party sees that the other side of the party is already finishing up their entree before they dig in, like a riot's going to break out, a mutiny. And so the demand peak is like just a spike, whereas at a restaurant, it's spread out a little bit more genially. Of course, there's a rush at 8 p.m. or whatever, but it's more like a bell curve.
And little things you can do as like a front of house manager to like meet, yeah.
Well, and everyone's not ordering the same thing.
Yes.
You see, there's also inevitably like this idea that everyone's being served the identical plate or maybe one of two options. But still, like the stresses that that puts on the kitchen are insane.
Ted, brides, grooms.
Oh, man.
Zilla.
We
talk about it. Is it real?
It is kind of real. In our work, I mean, again, it's kitchen work. I mean, think about it this way. There were very few weddings I work where anyone in the kitchen knew the name of the bride and groom other than me, because I was, you know, I was writing a book about it. And so for me, it was like a piece of information. But most times, like, the kitchen team doesn't know who the bride and groom is. They only know who the party planner is, because that's the person you're trying to please. That's the repeat business. And so they'll know who the party planner is and when the party planner is in the kitchen, but the bride and groom never come into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. That being said, there's, you know, I worked a really intense, really lavish, extravagant wedding where the groom ordered a special meal, and it was grilled chicken breast. And like, you know, in the context of like a beautiful meal that you're preparing for these people, and you've got 13 past apps, and this, you know, it's so beautiful. There is a way in which that weighs heavy, you know. Yeah. It's like, oh, actually, to this person, this whole party's about, like, the food is neither here nor there, you know?
We have a whole weddings chapter in this book. And what we noticed is that stylistically, there have been some trends in weddings in the menu selection. And it used to be, let's say, around the 2000, early 2000s, that what brides and grooms really wanted was a wedding that reflected tradition and kind of, you know, the fairy tale wedding. And then at a certain point, probably around the 2008 crash, the uber rich people for whom that was not necessarily a crash at all, raised the ante because caterers wanted to appease them and appeal to them. They had to.
And they needed to say yes to get the business.
They had to say yes to every whim. And so suddenly the idea of a hyper-personalized wedding where every single element, every single dish, every single food or beverage moment told a story about you meeting your, you know, spouse and became entrenched. And so suddenly now it's like the tale that's never been told, you know, Rich and Lisa's wedding. So these contortionist, like, from the catering standpoint, contortionist experiences are just incredible. And so you'll see the most gluttonous wedding ever with just like thousands and thousands of pounds and millions of dollars worth of food. And, you know, half of it goes in the trash.
I know. That's the key. And I think you write about this in the wedding chapter. You write about how Instagram is going to be about the bride's dress. It's going to be about the DJ. It's going to be about the dances. It's going to be about the speeches. But when is the food ever grammed or talked about?
Yeah. So and sad. And there is, you know, I think the rise, the customization of menus sort of coincided with that rise of Instagram. So there is pressure. Sometimes there is pressure on their food. There's pressure on every element to be like just so extraordinary, so special that everyone like, you know, hits like on their phone when they see the photo. But, you know, there are so many weddings for which the food may not be a big element, even though there's maybe spending $300,000 on it.
No, you know? Of course. And like you're spending all this time and effort and the food
we're
just
spending
is a backstory.
All this time and effort, but it's so clear, like the one I was telling you, like if the groom is not into it, why are we going through the motions? Like, why wouldn't they do like, I mean, I to me, it's like, it's a missed opportunity. It's like, why not do a whole wedding where the whole point was like grilled chicken? You know, that would be
tell that
like,
story.
Tell that story.
And almost nothing
that's
else.
That's a story that's never been told.
People are like basic. They have basic tastes and they're not creative. They think money's going
to. But it's just funny to me as someone who, you know, like, why if grilled chicken was your comfort zone, would you then do like a cocktail hour with literally at this event, I think there was like 13 or 16 different past items and stationed items. And there was a whole like noodles bar and the sushi bar and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, But why, you know,
at a certain
are
point,
we just checking off boxes? Yeah. I mean,
if you're telling too many stories at, you know, any party, whether it's a wedding or anything else, like, your audience can't absorb all that. That's too much. Like, focus on one thing that really, you know, syncs up with your theme or your message, and let everything else kind of be more or less comfort food.
I want to know, like, usually at weddings, there's like the food trucks roll up at the end of the night.
Yeah.
As the caterers, do you get like super bummed by like these food trucks rolling up and like, that's the big finale and that's what people are talking about? It's like a taco truck. And you spent like hours on that past apps.
Well, the two parties we worked that I remember when food trucks rolled up, it was definitely dessert, and it was literally probably the 24th or 25th item of dessert at that party. Okay, so like that was
this was
disgusting. At the valet stand.
I mean,
that was at the valet stand. That was like the final piece that you got at the valet stand. And the funny thing for us is like we were like, who has an appetite for a Belgian waffle after this party? That was one year. The other year was
a Sunday station and a, you know,
a s'more station. Like, there was past desserts. There was a whole pie
a
and cake
Blastro
bar.
There was special cake,
you know? Boss cake in the shape of a shark. It was like, oh my God, how could you put another bite in your mouth? And yet you'd be surprised. There was one time we were doing like fried beignets to order. It was like, these people are not going to want a beignet after this meal.
Like a wafer thin beignet.
And not only did they want the beignets, they wanted them hot. And so there was a point of service near the valet where you picked up your key, and people were coming to us directly. We were frying them right there,
you know,
like 20 yards away. And they were coming to us and they were like, oh yeah, those ones are cold. We want them hot.
Was that the Nancy Pelosi beignet incident?
Yes, that was the Nancy Pelosi.
It's beignet. A good reader. I'm not going to spoil our listener. I'm not going to spoil it. You should read this book and find out about it. I do want to talk about Martha Stewart, because you catered an event. I believe, is that her house?
No, it wasn't at her house. It was at a house in East Hampton.
Okay.
And, but we did see her, and I was so freaked out because Matt and I wrote her wine column for 5 years. We've been on her show. I mean, that's, you know, and I didn't want to be busted.
She's met a lot of people in her life. Ted had, you know, misplaced expectations that he'd be recognized.
I had misplaced expectations.
And surprise, she didn't.
And she didn't. And that was a moment where I was actually on the floor. I was manning the grill, right?
He was a hot dog tonger.
And so
she does like hot dogs.
And I was within, you know, 10 feet, maybe 5 feet of that station. You know, there was a point of service, but I was the one sort of, if anyone wanted something better, more done than it was, then I would take. So, but it's to your point, it's like, if you're in a catering uniform, people don't see you the way they see you in other. That was a huge learning experience.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
for one example, I was also in a front-facing Fiesta station on the West Side Highway somewhere. It was like the launch of a cruise ship concept kitchens or something. And they had media there and a ton of people who like go on cruises all the time. And I served what was her title?
She's the publisher time? Of...
The publisher of... the magazine Travel and Leisure that we worked for, a bowl of soup or something. She looked me straight in the eye and did not see me because I was in context, clearly a catering worker. I had on a black pillbox beanie, an ill-fitting polyester chef's jacket, and, you know, stained black pants and smudged black clogs. And if you're wearing that, you can walk into any building in Midtown Manhattan without a security badge or showing your ID, because it's obvious you are a catering worker.
And so there is that thing. It's like you're invisible, but you have this special power, you know, that you have an authority. So that's understood simply by virtue of the outline of your, you know, your silhouette. There's this authority. But as far as humanity, it's not always conferred, you know. And so that was what we struggled with a lot. And we still haven't resolved in our minds. Like,
who is working as a catering chef, as a caterer, as a cook on the line? Who are these workers?
So the Central American diaspora is very well entrenched. I think obviously, as it is throughout food service in New York and beyond. And that was actually the one ray of light, you know, a shred of humanity in this otherwise pretty brutal,
cynical world.
Food shoveling world. There's more interesting breakdowns like between prep and fiesta. So in the prep shift, that is more regular. That's more regular work. It's like, you know, Monday through Friday at sort of reasonable hours. And that tended to be both young and older people. So older people who had a family to go back to or a longer commute, and younger people who wanted to be out at bars on the weekend, because the fiesta shift, that is an accordion business that's like you might have three gigs to choose from between Friday and Saturday, mm-hmm. and none for the rest of the week. And those are intense, like more improvisational skill sets. So there's really different characters to different parts of the catering job.
And those, you know, the fiesta shifts tend to be a little bit more mercenary in the sense that, like, since you need to fill your schedule, you work with, you know, 10 different
caterers
mm-hmm. and you just book accordingly and you mm-hmm. try to fill your schedule with that.
Do you guys screen Party Down?
Yes. Oh, yeah. My God. That's one of my favorite
shows. I mean, when we started
ever.
This project, we were searching for something like this that told the story of how catering gets done and who the people are in it. And the only things we could find, the only sort of pop cultural references were Party Down and Jane Lynch.
Yeah.
But that's strictly cater waiter.
Yeah, no, you know, that's exactly. Kind that's kind of thinking the segue.
So it's not really about the food.
And that's the frustration is everyone's immediate thing is like, oh, Party Down. And it's like, oh, yeah, but that's the service yeah. element. And the food is simply
that is just skimming the surface of it. But then also Gabrielle Hamilton's Blood, Bones, and Butter has a chapter on it where she mostly like throws catering under the bus and claims to have hated it. What we heard from the catering world is that she was a brilliant caterer.
Yeah.
You know, everyone remembers like when she was in it.
Everyone wanted her on the shit on the party because she could do anything. You know.
Yeah, I mean, Danny Meyer has a very robust catering business, but other chefs have failed at it, right? I think we talk about, Bobby Flay.
It was the worst year of my life.
Right.
And part of that is, you know, it's just a different business and it's a cutthroat business. And the part that enraged him more than anything was that, you know, the party planner would do a tasting with him and with, you
kind
know, some other people. And, you know, and then later, and they would think they slammed it, like crushed it, got it, we got that job. And then the party planner would circle back and say, well, we've got them saying they can do the entree for, you know, 17 or, you know, or whatever.
Can you cut the price
can
of the
entree? Can you cut the price of the
25%?
Entree? And he was like, you fucking kidding me? Like, when have I ever had a customer say, I know the hanger steak is 17, but can you do it for 13?
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen. So it's a completely different.
And yet there are chefs like Danielle Boulou, who's very successfully partnered with
Feast and Fat.
What's the guy's name?
Oh,
anyhow, to create a huge business sort of in parallel.
I think
parallel
his name is Jean-Christophe Le Picard.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, nice accent.
And then someone like Chef Anita Lowe, mm-hmm. Who has really not gotten into catering, but she loves or at least tolerates working with the hot box. And nowadays, chefs are pushed into this position ever so much more so of taking your act on the road, going to a festival, cooking off-site, popping up, doing a residency. Mm-hmm. And so the catering skills are becoming more relevant.
Let's talk about the next projects because I wanted to – you guys have done several cookbooks and you're known as cookbook authors. Let's move on to that because I want to hear what book needs to be written by the Lee brothers, what cookbook?
Oh, gosh. Does anyone?
Well, we're not sure that any needs to be.
Okay.
And that's the problem. Like we're in an era where, you know, are we just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic? Like, you know, we have to get to more essential truths about food.
Mm-hmm.
And so just slicing the Southern cookbook pie thinner is not – what it's about for us,
but certainly from us, you know, like think about the Southern cookbooks that have come out in the last year. So amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, turnip greens and tortillas, coconuts and collard greens. Mm-hmm. Like those are voices that are coming out of the South that haven't been heard from really. And that's what excites us about the future. Like no one needs a fourth Lee Brothers cookbook. Like we've metabolized what it's like to grow up in downtown Charleston in the 1980s.
I mean, I wouldn't say that we'd never do a cookbook because we love the process of developing recipes. Like that really is something I think we do okay at. And And we love that process of making cookbooks. But maybe in the role of editors or something
okay,
like that.
Okay, I see. But you still are keeping your eyes on food media, right?
Oh, absolutely. Totally. Yeah. I mean, you know, we do this project with Rizzoli where we – it's called the Lee Brothers Classic Library where we reissue out-of-print and vintage cookbooks. And that was a project that came – sort of fell out of the sky in our laps thanks to an editor there. And that's really fun, like to really think about what are the books that we feel need to be brought back into print because there may be a younger generation that's sort of missing the link between, you know.
Yeah, we've talked about a lot here with Taste, and we've talked about the reissue, the paradigm. I think from a business point of view, it can be challenging to do reissues with rights and everything.
Oh, totally.
It's incredible. You have to go, you know, through 10 hurdles before you get to step one.
Lots of hurdles. But what are some of the books that you've reissued through this kind of umbrella?
The first one was the one that we were just aching to do. It's Princess Pamela's Soul Food Cookbook from 1969. And it's just...
It was mispublished in the first instance... physically because it was a crumbly acidified paperback. So most of the copies that exist now are not worth cooking from. And it was published as a tiny little thing, so it was hard to cook from it because you couldn't open it without cracking the spine. Anyhow, we scaled it up, made it hardcover. It had to be redesigned. And that was a fun process. And
But we Gail did Anderson feel like there was, you know, there was a lot of young chefs that we knew coming out of the South saying like, oh, look at my buttermilk pie, you know, and you taste it and you'd be like, yeah, I know. It seems like Princess Pamela maybe influenced you. And they'd be like, oh, no, I worked at, you know, at City Grocery or, you know, for John Currents. And, you know, the sort of you could follow the tutelage from Pamela Strobel to Bill Neal to John Currents.
Or that Robert generation, Stelling.
Or yeah. Robert Stelling, you know, there were a lot of people who came through that. And, you know, whether people carry on and give credit, like Bill Neal was scrupulous about like giving credit to where his sources were. But just to sort of close that gap and be like, here's the original, you know, here's an original from the 60s.
It's also cool work, just as you know, to write that new introduction.
Oh,
and
it's the
to,
best.
You know, process a little bit more about the book and to provide more context, more biography, and to solve some of the riddles that the first book might
have
posed.
Did you reshoot it?
Well, there were no photographs in the original,
in the 69
which was kind
edition.
Of merciful.
That's good. What else is on the docket for this?
So the one we just published last year is also coincidentally from 1969, was Graham Kerr, The Galloping Gourmet's first cookbook, which against all expectation was ruthlessly scientific and beautifully laid out, super modernist and super ahead of its time for having three forms of measurement and having this interesting take on the foods of the South Pacific. Because he created it when he was living over 7 years in New Zealand.
Yeah, his father was in the Navy.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we published a profile in 2017 on Graham, and we went and found him in Seattle living
in
retirement.
That was a beautiful piece.
Heather R. Anderson wrote that. Really nice piece. Great chef. Like, wow.
Yeah.
Transformative. And if you talk to chefs of a certain generation, they're like, oh, yeah, like, I love that. And, you know, my mom had it on the television all the time, and it really influenced me. And then the other reaction we get is like, oh, we're republishing Graham Kerr, and everyone's like, he's still alive, you know. And
not only is he still alive, he's still got his chops. Like, he is so entertaining and so sharp and clever. What was cool about that project, which we'll probably never be able to experience again, is that he was able to go back to his own work and annotate it, handwrite. Like, I've got these handwritten sort of comments on stuff that we were able to lay over the recipe. And that layer, you know, just adding layers to a cookbook of content is really kind of fun.
Is there a third? Can you announce? Is there another
one?
We can't announce
a third. We're still wrestling
with
those hurdles and stuff.
And a lot of times, you know, like with the rights thing with Princess Pamela, it was someone in this very building that owned the rights, and we tried to chase down that and find out whether that was a work for hire or were they in contact with family members, because they would know, and that we never got a response.
We record these at Penguin Random House headquarters. That is what this building is, and it is a serious pain in the ass trying to track down rights. But when you end up doing it, it's so worth it. So yeah. We will look for the third iteration of your reprint series.
Thank you.
Love
thank
it.
Thank you.
Matt Lee and Ted Lee, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thanks so much for having us.
The Taste Podcast is hosted by Matt Rodbard and me, Anna Heasel. The show is produced by Gabrielle Lewis, studio recordings by Pat Stango, theme music by Steve Rydell. Interviews are recorded live at Books Are Magic in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, and at Penguin Random House Studios in Manhattan. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com. Thanks for listening.